Okay, well, everybody's quiet. Just playing that visualization of a simulation slash NASA press release to give a kind of sense of what the structure of the material around a supermassive black hole binary might actually look like. That is taken ultimately from real simulation data with certain guesses about the photon emissivity, but the basic physical structures are genuine, and the relativistic ray tracing effect that you saw as it changed, as the viewing angle displayed changed, those are all genuine as well. So the subject this morning is, for those of us impatient to find supermassive black hole binaries and can't wait for LISA to fly, or at least don't want to wait for LISA to fly, question is, how can we look for them now? And of course, what that means is to use the technology we have available, which works on photons. You know, there are a couple of neutrino detectors, but they're pretty unlikely to see anything from, you know, black hole binaries at redshift 1. So the focus here is on the photons associated with black hole binaries, and that could be at any stage of evolution. Most of the proposals that people have made have to do with the stage well before the merger actually takes place. And I'll explain as we go through why that's so. But the first question is, we're accustomed now to seeing lots and lots of LIGO black hole, double black hole mergers, totally photon free. And so why is there any reason to think that it will be different for the supermassive variety? And the simplest, dumbest argument to demonstrate why the supermassive variety should be different is just to look at the scaling of Bondi accretion. Imagine you have a mass surrounded by interstellar gas, and you can freely change the mass. The Bondi accretion rate scales like m squared. If you go from 10 or 30 solar masses to 10 or 30 million solar masses, that's a big advantage. It's a lot more accretion. And in a certain sense, that really is the central point. Now, in addition, unlike the stellar mass variety, there are a number of other processes that are also likely to contribute. In a sense, more physical, more realistic than absolutely spherically symmetric zero angular momentum Bondi accretion. And in particular, the most likely way to bring two supermassive black holes into a single galaxy is to do it as a result of merging the galaxies first. Merging galaxies automatically creates dynamical disturbances inside the new merged galaxy, and dynamical disturbances are good tools for pushing gas to the center. This is seen in all kinds of galaxy merger simulations, and the mechanisms are natural things like strongly non-axisymmetric perturbations in the density distribution of the galaxy, so you can break angular momentum conservation on the axis. Likewise, shock waves, which of course are effective on gas and not on stars, etc. So having a reasonable amount of mass accretion onto a supermassive black hole binary is in fact a plausible, reasonable expectation, which is not particularly for a tens of solar mass stellar black hole binary. Okay. Now, if we're to look for them, the nature of the game is that the universe is full of AGN, you know, creating solitary supermassive black holes. And most binary black hole systems, supermassive black hole systems, should basically look a lot like solitary ones, because most of the energy is released, most of the energy released in accretion comes out near, and black hole, comes out near the ISCO. And what I'll show you happens in these binaries is that a small disk forms around each of the black holes, and each of those black holes, you know, has an, each of those disks has a near ISCO region where most of the light is emitted in, for most of parameter space. That region is well insulated from large scales, and so it should look just like an ISCO accretion rate onto a solitary black hole of that mass, period. Yes. Yes.
Claiming that you could end up clearing the disks on either black hole with spooky material through torques. Is that no longer?
Well, it turns out to be wrong for an interesting reason. I'll get there in a couple of minutes, but their particular argument actually applied to a late stage in the evolution of the binary. And what I'm talking about now is more general and pertains, you know, throughout the evolution. So it's when the separation is fairly wide, it was before their argument would apply. Okay. And if each of these little disks looks like its own AGN, the light adds up, and we'll have a hard time telling that system apart from an ordinary solitary AGN just by its photons.
Wouldn't we have some modulation? Or is the modulation so negative that there's no chance for?
Depends on circumstances, and that's going to be part of the discussion. And there are different varieties of modulation that may or may not be possible. Okay, so we want to somehow find a signature that can definitely separate the binaries, and that's also because they're going to be a small fraction of the population. So we need to guard against the possibility that what we think might be a binary is in fact just a weird solitary. You know, 1 in 1,000 solitary, well, there maybe the binaries are 1 in 1,000 of the total population. So, what is basic structure? And maybe what I should do is actually flip. I don't know whether to put these figures ahead or behind. Maybe I'll just show you the figure first. This is a pair of images showing the midplane density in a simulation of accretion onto a pair of black holes, but really it's a pair of mass points, because this was done under the assumption that the separation is large enough that dynamics are Newtonian. But it is, on the other hand, 3D MHD.
What simulations are these doing?
Oh, these are by Jiming Shi from 7 years ago. Okay. Actually, these are more slight. This is 7 years ago. That's only 4 or 5 years ago. Okay. And the Q is just a ratio of secondary to primary mass. So equal mass on the left, ratio of 10 to 1 on the right. The little white dots represent the mass points. In these simulations, there is a cutout surrounding the binary. So that's not simulated. It's showing only the circumbinary disk. One of the striking things you can see here, well, maybe now I'll flip back to the words, and we'll keep those images in mind.
So are these orbits circular?
Pardon?
Are the binaries circular?
Yes.
Orbit circular?
Yes. Yes, circular in this case.
Do they evolve in time?
In this simulation, no. Because, among other reasons, the simulations ran something like 50 or 60 binary orbits. And over that period of time, for reasonable accretion rates, mass ratios, separations, et cetera, you wouldn't expect any. Maybe just, you know, a tiny amount of evolution. Okay. So the first point, as you could see in those images, is that generically there's a low density gap at the center of the system. And this is cleared out whenever the binary mass ratio Q is greater than a few percent. Andrew here? Anyways, that number of few percent comes from a paper by one of Andrew's students. In fact, I should remark that this is essentially a review of Andrew's talk from, what was it, a week ago Friday. One of the satisfying things about this subject is that there are a number of competing simulational groups, and everyone agrees on all these points. We all get to see the same things. the radius of that gap is typically about twice the binary separation.
I got tons of questions, but so that occurs below some given distance. I mean, if they're arbitrary, very, very far apart, there's no gap.
Newtonian gravity is scale-free. If you have a binary in Newtonian gravity and mass accreting onto it from the outside, it will form a gap provided the mass ratio is greater than a few percent. That's what I said, a bound binary.
The problem is when it's greater than a few percent, eccentricity gets excessive.
It can.
Very quickly. No, it does. It's well known that it does. If you start with circular orbit, you evolve over long periods of time. Eccentricity always gets excited.
Well, I'm curious about the evidence because at the moment, there's actually quite a debate going on in the simulational community about even the sign of the net angular momentum transfer, and people have a very hard time actually measuring the energy change.
Well, in planet context, people have done lots of simulations to show that if the mass ratio is greater than a few percent, the eccentricity gets excited.
And how do they handle the problem of angular momentum and energy transfer?
Well, many of these simulations are using the same code, similar type of code, through many different codes. And there are also end-of-the-day calculations.
Okay, well, I'd like to see the simulations on that, because as I said, in the cube...
Check out Willy Klein and various others.
Okay, let's look at that, because as I said, for the larger Q regime, this is a much debated point, and I want to see whether they answer the questions.
Accumulation.
Yes, but that was number one, SPH. Number two, I don't believe tracked the accretion transfer. And what I recall of their argument for eccentricity was based on linear theory, that is small q, and analytic arguments.
Well, it's been repeated many times by Nelson's group, by Wise group, by various people. Greenleaf's group, eccentricity always gets excited when it's greater than a few percent.
Is there a saturation level? Is there a level at which
when the eccentricity gets to a saturation level?
Yes.
It's above order 0.5 or more.
Okay.
So just to add on that, I would say probably that the kind of simulations that Julian has in mind, they are not yet at the stage where they can evolve thousands of orbits that you would need quasi-mass regime. But this type of simulation with SPH, with self-gravitating disks and stuff like that, have been done for supermassive local binaries, and also in those. Eccentricity is generally excited. There was a first paper by, I think, the first one was Armitage and Matera, and then Jorge Cuadra, and then Constanze Rödig. In that paper, actually, there was also a sort of saturation of eccentricity around 0.6, 0.7, but that is, SPH with a very hydrodynamic SPH.
Three different types.
But what I should remark is that MHD gives quantitatively different numbers from alpha hydro for the angular momentum carried by accretion. And in these MHD simulations, there is a near cancellation between the torque exerted by the binary on the outside gas and the rate at which angular momentum is brought into the binary system, which means that it's a delicate matter to calculate that balance.
But the eccentricity excitation depends on angular momentum and energy.
Yeah, that's right. But what I'm emphasizing is that defining that balance is a careful quantitative question that's numerically tricky. And that's why I'm skeptical about the robustness of those results.
I believe this question has been addressed many, many times because low-ranking linear calculations show that it should be excited. But when these folks did the things with very low mass, they don't. When the Q is greater than 2%, it starts to go. It goes through many, many, many checks. Believe me, these guys really have done a very careful job.
Except they're using Alpha Hydro.
No, some of them actually use MHD turbines.
For this?
Nelson's work. Check out Nelson's work.
That'd be surprising. I know Nelson's work in other areas where he's not used MHD.
He has done some with MHD.
Okay. Well, let's leave that aside, but I think the basic point has, by the way, I would not insist that they stay circular. I mean, in my mind, that's an open question because of this numerical delicacy. These simulations were done circular because it's the simplest initial choice. And I don't think that eccentricity, in the end, is going to alter many of these features.
It is, because whether there's gas flow through the gap or not, depends on it.
That would be very surprising.
That was why people were surprised when GW Ori was first observed. There's clearly gas flow through it.
Yes, and what we see is steady gas flow. Or not, I should say, not time steady, but it is consistently flowing through.
Julian, I mean, it would not be a surprise if the orbit ends up being eccentric because the cavity itself is very lopsided.
Oh, that's what I said.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm not making the argument that they will stay circular. I'm just making the argument that in the work that I was aware of, it was a much debated question. And these were circular because it was just a simple starting point.
And they don't have GR in it. They don't have, but they do have various treatment of radiation transfer, various treatment of even some prescription of turbines.
And also with these supermassive black holes, what would be the argument that they even begin circular?
Oh, not in particular.
Oh, sorry, Alberto just noticed that there was some work by Delbaye and Escala showing that there are conditions when you don't open a gap. This was mostly when the disks are sufficiently thick.
Mm-hmm. And by thick, you mean geometrically thick, so hot.
Yeah. When H is greater than the Roche radius, mm-hmm. in the low mass limit.
Right, but that's a different.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah. But just the point that
may not be gas.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, when the mass ratio is even smaller, that is qualitatively different.
So one thing about eccentricity, I mean, in this particular field, I think it would be fair to say that in the simple case with the SPH, eccentricity has been explored. In this more, case with GR, MHD, et cetera, for now only circular binary has been considered. And I think in most of the simulations, I don't, well, now you can do this, but in most of the simulations, the actual binary wasn't even a live point. I mean, it was just a potential relating. So people are getting there.
That's right. Yeah. And when the binaries get close, then the arguments for circularity are not watertight, but they're stronger.
Sure.
Right, basically, it's the nature of evolution under gravitational radiation. Okay, now just remark that the fundamental physical reason for opening a gap is that when you get to within a few times binary separation, the potential is no longer monopolar, the quadrupole contribution is significant, and there's both a time average quadrupole and a time-varying quadrupole. So that pretty well destroys the ability to have simple circular orbits in that region. And generically, there are a pair of streams that leave the inner edge of the circumbinary disk. You can see them here and here. It's a little harder to see that here because the secondary is right there. Close, it's kind of buried in it. And now to return to one of Lewis's earlier questions. In the early days of the subject, it was argued that the torques were so strong that matter would just pile up at roughly 2A. And those arguments were based on essentially 1D models. Once people turned to 2D and 3D models, it was recognized that, in fact, the matter leaks through the inner edge quite effectively. And the mechanism is actually of interest. The material leaving the inner edge of the disk has a modest distribution of specific angular momentum. Fluid elements with angular momentum near the circular orbit angular momentum that position go around. They stay in the gap region for a while. That's where the torques are especially strong. And that material actually gains an angular momentum and goes back out and strikes the inner edge of the disk, rejoins it. So, outstop accretion. But when it rejoins the disk, there's a shock, a bleak shock. A bleak shock deflects the material. Deflecting the material is a transfer of angular momentum right there, because the material has been turned. That now creates a portion of the fluid distribution with a lower specific angular momentum, which then takes a deeper dive toward the binary with less time for the torques to act, and it's that material which reaches the domain of the binary and feeds the mini disks. Okay. Another robust feature for Q greater than about 0.1 or 0.2 is that the disk spontaneously grows in asymmetry, which you can see quite strongly here. And that is actually generated by the process I just described. The material that falls off, gets torqued up, goes back out to the outer disk, arrives in a way that is synchronized so that it basically lands close to the point where it took off from. And so asymmetries are self-reinforcing features. And as a result of that asymmetry, the total mass accretion rate is modulated with the orbital frequency of that asymmetry. So that's the orbital frequency of an orbit at a radius of about 2a. That's about 0.2 of the binary orbital frequency. Another general feature.
Besides being also periodic on the period of the binary. I mean, there are both periods in the, well, stronger, one stronger than the other, depending on the simulation and on the group.
Yeah, these,
both of them,
yeah, both in ours and in Andrew's, in the Newtonian, well, Andrew's all Newtonian, almost all Newtonian limit. The 0.2 one, the lower one, is actually the stronger. At the end, I'll show a figure from a later stage where the spectrum is richer.
Right.
Anyway, so secondary captures more mass than the primary. And actually, you can almost see that happening in the image. I pointed out that the secondary was buried in that stream. Well, the secondary, of course, is going around in here. And essentially, it's triggering mass inflow and captures the matter as it sweeps around. And
in the lifetime of days, how much mass would it capture?
The secondary, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Everyone's calculations give the same qualitative result, that the secondary captures more than the primary. The actual functional dependence is a little waffly. So I can't give you a strong, clear answer.
But okay.
Should say, however, that the total rate, the time average total rate of accretion through the inner edge basically should reach equilibrium with the feeding rate at large distance.
So that's kind of like saying there's a gap that's going to be slowed down that much.
That's right. Yes. Okay. And I think we've already discussed that. Talk about this shock, but not this one. When those accretion streams come in and hit the little disks around the individual masses, they're strong shocks. And we'll talk about them later. Okay, now we come back to another of Lewis's questions. The argument made by Milosavljevic and Finney was that at this stage, much late time, when the time scale for orbital evolution by gravitational radiation is faster than the characteristic inflow time for material to sift in through the circumbinary disk, that the binary will shrink, the inner edge can't keep up, and that would cut off further accretion. The first part about the binary shrinks and the disk can't keep up is absolutely correct. The second part about cutting off accretion turns out not to be. And one way to see this is that the way you define the characteristic inflow time is just imagine the time to cross, you know, one E folding in radius. So it's more or less R over VR, appropriately mass average. But when the orbital evolution time is short compared to the inflow time, you don't have much time to accrete over. The binary is shrinking faster, which means that in order to sustain accretion over that short period of time, you don't need to go out a factor or two in radius. You just need to draw in material that's already near the edge. And the time scale to traverse that short delta R is not very great. In addition, there are various edge effects that make the sort of standard definition of the inflow time invalid at the edge of a disk in any case. But again, all the simulations show that despite rapid shrinking in the gravitational radiation dominated period, the accretion keeps up.
So there's still accretion, but the rate of accretion doesn't go down. Like, no. There's less material around.
Okay. The rate seems not to change very much because there are intrinsic fluctuations in the rate. There are uncertainties at the tens of percent level, but it does not change beyond that tens of percent level. What happens to it, I'll show at the very end.
But I wonder if you can go into this in a little more detail, because Milosavljevic and Finney actually tried to incorporate some edge effects. They actually tried to have a little bit of a consideration that you would have steeper gradients near the inner edge, which would drive things faster. And I think their argument was that because you have such a strong dependence of the gravitational in-spiral time on the semi-major axis, that it would change where the decoupling would happen, but not that the decoupling would happen. The zeroth order thing you do is you say, what's VR, what's the memory? And you compare that from standard disk theory with what you get from the in-spiral due to gravitational radiation.
What was the nature of the edge effects?
I think they basically had a fudge factor, which basically increased the rate at which the inner edge of the disk could fall
down. Or the steeper gradient.
Yes, because there's a curiosity which is a staple of MHD simulations that in one context is basically a numerical artifact that you don't care about, but in other contexts it has physical implications. And that is the standard way all MHD global MHD simulations of accretion are set up, is that you lay down a finite amount of mass on the grid in some kind of hydrostatic disposition, and that there is actually an analytic solution for doing it with edges. There's no gas inside a certain inner edge and no gas outside the outer edge.
Yeah.
You then lay down a magnetic field inside the material, commonly a purely poloidal field, not exclusively. But now if you ask what happens at the inner edge when these simulations start out, the answer is that generically they develop, you know, I should sketch this on the board. So you have this mass point, and you have a lump of material out here. And this is endowed with, say, simple loops of magnetic field. After a little bit of time, you see the density contours stretching out like this. And, of course, taking magnetic field with them. What's going on here is that it's a sort of, in some ways, it's a coherent version of the magnetorotational instability. Imagine a little bump forms on the inside. So now there's some radial field. The orbital shear creates some azimuthal field. BRB phi is a heavy stress. The sine of the orbital shear automatically makes it one that carries angular momentum outward. So that means that this material is losing angular momentum, and fairly rapidly, because this is, at this point, coherent and laminar. And the end result is that basically matter moves inward a great deal faster than would be predicted on the basis of, you know, classic alpha modeling.
There is no point at which the inner edge of this can not keep up, because very roughly here, the fluid can talk, it increases at the speed of sound, while this black hole can move, or it's gone by the speed of light at some point. So at some point, it has to be this attachment. What's wrong?
Besides this effect, now Andrew's here, so besides the this magnetic field effect in any simulation the one where you have the
we're
talking about whether the gas can keep up with the binary when, as the binary sure decouples. Okay.
Yes.
So you have a simulation, the recent simulation, they are hydro, right? There's no magnetic field.
That's right. It's just right. Pure hydro.
And there you find that I just give you a break, you can see this. And there they find that the gas keeps in flowing throughout the spiral. The rate in that case diminishes a little bit toward the end, and maybe, you know, if you add the magnetic stresses, that wouldn't even happen. But there is still a significant amount of gas inflow and accretion. And I think what is missing inherently in the picture, in the, you know, early picture of Pinon-Losada, which is any asymmetric torque on the disk, right? Because it's a 1D model, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And it's just based mostly on comparison of timescales.
So the normal viscous timescale is like 1 over alpha CS squared.
Sure.
Or when you have a steep gradient, you get rid of 1 of the C. So it's actually a sound propagation time rather than a viscous diffusion time. Eventually, you get to a point that you can actually violate the Rayleigh's criteria, because when you have an empty hole on the inside with a steep gradient, there is a pressure gradient force going inwards. So that will give you multiplication of omega and kappa. Mm-hmm. But when you violate the Rayleigh's criteria, in fact, it becomes dynamically unstable. It can actually fall at the free fall time. So you can keep it up.
Yeah. Which is essentially what's happening here as the matter loses angular momentum by the magnetic stresses.
And so to continue following up here, so if this is happening, then I at some point I would expect that there'd be a depletion of the matter. Because far enough out in the disk, it's draining more rapidly than it would normally. So is part of what you're saying that although there might be such depletion of matter, all this happens on such a short time scale that the depletion isn't felt in a significant way.
Yes.
So you don't actually block the accretion.
In fact, in terms of this kind of picture, redraw this. So now imagine, here's this disk. And if you define the inflow time, what you mean is the time for matter to get from here to there. But as you were saying, precisely because this time, the binary evolution time, is short compared to that inflow time, you can't draw on matter from way out there. However, you can draw on matter at closer separations. It doesn't take as long for it to travel inward. Mm-hmm. And this time, crudely, I'm trying to sort of represent in some schematic way the evolution time scale. Mm-hmm. And of course, as the binary shrinks, the evolution time scale also shrinks rapidly, which means that right at the nominal decoupling time, they're comparable, but then it goes.
Right, but you would expect a drop in the accretion rate, but not a huge drop in the accretion rate. Is that fair to say? Because you're depleting matter faster than it's being supplied.
Yes. Because the intrinsic fluctuations are sizable,
uh-huh.
It's hard to discern in the simulation.
So it's tens of percent is the depletion that you might expect.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't have this figure in my prepared slides, but there's actually a plot of this in Noble et al. 2012. And you can see it's down by 10 or 20% compared to a paired simulation in which the binary orbit was frozen. But, is that fluctuation? Is that real? I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Maybe we studied these a lot. So, you think about, what possibly could you look for in the photons? Well, these are the knobs you can turn. You've got the continuum shape. You've got line profiles and strengths. So there's spectral properties. And of course, in any possible band in which the system emits. And there's potentially periodic modulation. And the name of the game here is to find out which of these possible mechanisms is the most tightly tied to the system status of the binary and is the most observable. Now, there are a couple of generic problems that beset almost all attempts to find examples. One of them is this, as mentioned before, it's important that these properties be very strongly tied to binaries and not to solitaries, because the population of solitaries is so much larger than the binaries, you could be fooled by a small number of statistical outliers from the solitary population. A second one is that if we're using theoretical arguments to make predictions about the properties, then you need a fair level of confidence in these arguments. That they couldn't be upset by some other mechanism, by other parameter regimes, and so on. On the observational side, they're independent problems. The first of them is kind of the generic problem of all astronomy. Are there enough of these bright enough you can see them? Now, if you're looking for the imprint of the binary, then crudely speaking, you're probably interested in light that's basically making use of energy on the scale of the binary binding energy. So in relativistic terms, order RG over A. And that means you're not going to have much energy to play with until the binary separation is not enormous. Let's say smaller than maybe 1,000 in gravitational units. On the other hand, the lifetime under gravitational wave losses alone is getting short. Scaling factor, 10^5 years roughly for separations of 1,000 RG and scale with the mass of the system. And of course, the more energy you have available to work with, the shorter the lifetime, and therefore the fewer the objects in the sky. Periods, you would expect to be a powerful indicator, but they're tricky to pick up observationally for a couple of reasons. The first of them is that the intrinsic variability power spectrum of AGN is generically, quote, red noise. That is, just it's noise, the phases of the different Fourier components are uncorrelated, and red, the power spectrum, decreases from low frequency to high. Okay. Now, when the logarithmic slope of the power spectrum is as steep as -1 or more, generically, in any finite train of data of length capital T, you will see features in the time series that look more or less periodic, with a period of maybe a third of the duration of the observation. And that's simply because the variance in the time series is dominated by the longest time cells. You know, that the integral of the power spectrum is the variance, and this is a steep power spectrum. So you'll always see something down near the low end of what you can see. And that another way of looking at that is to say, if you think something is periodic, you really want to see more than a few cycles. And I'll just say that many people have been fooled by this. And the gold standard of you got fooled is, of course, to extend the period of observation and then discover that the period goes away to be replaced by one a few times longer. And that has been seen in an example or two.
If I could add a comment to that, because at Maryland there's been some analysis of this. One sort of next level type of way in which people can be fooled, because they have become aware that red noise exists. And the next level thing that a lot of people will do is they'll say, okay, we'll use a damped random walk as a model for the noise. And then we have a particular model for which we have the noise, and you can use some procedures to say, well, is my T over 3 period unexpectedly large given the damped random walk model? Mm-hmm. But one of the things that was pointed out by Utley and others is that when you look at a large sample of AGN, not all of them are damped random walks. Some of them, for example, have steeper continuum power spectrum at low frequencies. So this is sort of a next order thing where people are still finding periods like that, but they're now arguing that it's okay because compared to a damped random walk, this is an unexpected
In fact, putting in the hypothesis of damped random walk is tantamount to saying it's not red noise at low frequencies.
Yeah, it's got to be flat at some point. But
yeah, but that's not necessarily justified on the time scale of the observations.
Yes, and even the ones where it's the frequency of the -2 all the way down to the lowest frequencies they see, that can also be misleading because the continuum power spectrum could be steeper than -2, in which case there's no signal, but you think that there's an excess compared to your particular model.
Yeah, in fact, if I can give you a pet peeve of mine, there's a very widely cited paper, McLeod et al. 2012, I think it is, which used a combination of Sloan data and Palomar sky survey plates to try to define the long-term structure function for a sample of quasars. And what's remarkable is that there is a plot in their paper which shows the log of the structure function against the log of the time scale, and the data look like, that's the Sloan data look like that. And the Palomar Sky Survey stuff is sort of up in there, actually sort of comes over like that.
Okay. Would you mind turning on the light?
Oh, right, okay. Okay.
Thanks.
And big error bars on this. They fit a pure power law model to power spectrum. Yeah. They fit a damp random walk. It goes like that. And they announced that they favor the damp random walk.
So those are the data?
I kid you not.
Do they explain why? Is there some motivation?
I haven't had a chance to ask any of the authors what was
it.
McLeod. M-A-C-L-E-O-D. And there are several versions of the structure function plot in that paper, and they all basically show something similar to that.
Okay.
Anyway. There's also another problem with period hunting, which I guess I didn't realize people were skirting until Aaron Barth sent me an email about it last week. And that is, you know, there are standards for sort of statistical significance of peaks in power spectra. And those are generally defined with respect to the significance of a peak at a particular frequency. When you're doing this kind of experiment, you're measuring the power spectrum over a range of frequencies, and you would be happy, you'd say, ah, there's a period, if there were a peak anywhere in that set of frequencies. That means you need a stronger significance test to believe in the one you've chosen. To avoid that standard, that strengthening of the test, is variously called a posteriori statistics, or a misuse of false alarm probabilities. Basically, it's the same idea. And I guess I had not read the papers carefully enough to realize that they weren't making this correction until he pointed that out. So it's a tough business. And just get you a sense of scale. This is also relates to the degree of difficulty, that if you want to have at least 5, 10, 15 periods, you have to wait a while. You know, how many graduate student thesis writing periods do you have to pile up before you?
It's not so bad, right? It's a few years.
Yeah, but
oh, well, maybe you want higher masses.
Let's play the devil's advocate. So the object OJ287 has been observed for a long time. You can argue that it has more than a few cycles. There are more than a few outbursts observed in that period of time. And yet, people are not convinced by just periodicity in the light curve.
Amongst other things.
The actual period
the promoters claim changes every time they have a new data set. And these are very non-linear fluctuations. The model that they fit to get a good chi-squared generally adds a free parameter or two every new data set.
The point is that even observing many cycles is not a silver bullet. Unless you have some other kind of evidence.
Or the data cooperative, and it really is periodic.
Yeah, without
noise,
I guess.
Or just, it really is. There are systems in the world we're confident are periodic.
I think this is certainly a very good point. I mean, one of the reasons I think that people, so one of the reasons I have some skepticism about OJ287 is that it's, and as Julian was saying, it's not simply a matter of this is a period of a particular phase. which you then apply over a dozen of the putative periods, is that you have a lot of other free parameters that come into the model that are necessary. You have the decay of the orbit, which is something that has to come in. You have things like a delay between when the secondary putatively punches through the accretion disk and when there's an emission. Right. So in contrast, and maybe with some optimism here, people are not trying to model things except that there is a period with a particular phase, which they figure is a fixed period. So maybe if we had a dozen periods for one of these things, then we would feel a little bit more convinced than with OJ-287, but what do you think?
Maybe, but since the situation with supermassive black hole binaries is a little more complex than with stellar binaries, because of the orbital evolution, because of the surrounding medium, which may be optical effect and all those things, I think that it always has to come with additional independent evidence in order to be a convincing case for a binary. Unless, it would have to be really a striking clean period in order to be enough evidence by itself, just based on a light curve of some sort of latency binary. My opinion, yeah.
Excuse me, I haven't followed up on the OJ stuff since years ago, but I remember years ago reading papers where they made predictions for when experts should be. Yes. Was that thing not quite correct, and they had to add parameters? Is that what you're saying?
Essentially, yes.
But the flare was around the time you were predicting.
That's right.
Yeah, well, the problem, I think the main problem there is that the model has as many free parameters as there are outbursts. So. The next outburst came a little bit earlier, and then you say, "Ah, well, because it's very massive relativistic binary, so it has, of course, you're seeing a little bit of GR shrinking. So there is some extra parameter. You can always, you know, there are like eight outbursts and, you know, 15 parameters.
But to Tamara's point, wants to say that this, the same story is not going to play out here. If you actually look at some motivation, people would argue for a very long time before you say, "Oh, this may be a binary."
Yeah, unless it's really clean.
Yeah. Good for data. Variable, yeah. Naturally, intrinsically, and on the top of that, you may have periodicity of some sort, and you have to convince yourself that that's what we've seen.
Good. Do you, anyone want to comment on future prospects? Because we were just discussing Eurozeta is going to be launched in about a week, and there's LSS too.
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah,
really?
It's the 21st, yes. The Julian.
Finally.
Well, we'll see if it actually happens, but if that's up for a few years, that's tens of orbits, right? And then,
The main problem with the Rosetta is that you, for most of the sky, you get 8 points in your light curves, because, you know, it's 6 months to cover the whole sky.
So
you can pick things that are wildly varying, but...
That's over some.
Yeah, I see.
8 points.
8 points? We can feed this.
Yeah. We will have candidates again, and then as the mass says, you need other problems.
That's right.
So it's going to be, a multiple sieving process.
So isn't it the case that for, I think in the, okay, well, we're talking about the drone pool, but in the at high energy, like in the X-ray, then things vary widely, but on relatively short time scale. Isn't it the case that the long behavior, the longer time scale are actually a bit steadier in there? So if you see a wide variation in terms of, you know, years in the X-ray, well, whether it's a pedal disruption or something else, but it wouldn't be near a single EGN.
The data are kind of rough, because if you are interested in several years to 10-year timescales, you know, satellite lifetimes and so on, the lore, and I don't think this is all that well defined, is that there are some AGN whose X-ray spectra have been seen to roll over at low frequencies. Where that happens, not too surprisingly, seems correlated with luminosity, in the sense that the higher luminosity need to go to longer timescales before you see the rollover. But that's kind of spotty data.
Okay.
Sorry, we're talking about X-rays here, but
than to expect. And the X-rays are coming from quantum, like scattering. These discs will emit thermal radiation up to UV, then you need to assume that the coronae are compact and are not washing out. The modulation, the intrinsic modulation via multiple scattering orders.
There are other washouts that will probably come into play first. In fact, some of these questions are things I have more detail on to show you. So let me move to that. Okay, so most of the proposals have to do with fairly long-lived signals. So these are in the period when the, it may be in the gravitational wave-dominated portion, range of separations, but the evolution time is still very long. Okay, so at the end, I want to talk about some signals that be more, quote, event-like, rather short duration. Okay, so one of the proposals for something that might occur is that the thermal spectrum of the accretion disk that in solitary AGN creates the optical UV portion would be interrupted by the gap. And if the temperature scale that would have been radiated at a radius of the binary separation, if it were a single solitary system with that mass, if that temperature scale was called KT naught, then if you just add up the light from a classical Novikov-Thorne circumbinary disk interrupted at a sharp edge, and then add the light from a pair of mini disks that start up at a tidal truncation radius inside the Roche lobes, again, simple-minded Novikov-Thorne, then you get spectral shapes that look like that, where the different curves are for different mass ratios. So I call this the notch, or Cole and I call this the notch. In fact, Alberto, did you also call it notch in your paper?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yes, had the embarrassing moment a few weeks ago recognizing that what Cole and I did had actually been preceded the qualitative level by what Alberto did. And we were unaware of it.
Particularly because our co-author was on Alberto's paper.
And never met.
Some information.
In any case, so there's, this is constructed on that simplistic picture for the emission, and surely there are edge effects. And this is something that Andrew and his group have also investigated. And in their approach, rather than the sort of analytic modeling, if you take simulation data, and you'll recall I spoke about shocks, both the torqued streams going out and hitting the circumbinary disk, and the accretion streams hitting the mini disks. And in their models, that dissipation is included in this thermal emission. That significantly fills in the notch. And so the question observationally is, does that energy actually come out in thermal emission? Okay. Now, a couple of other caveats here.
Is it fair?
No. That's it. This was a simplistic picture. this was a zeroth order level approximation, basically doing what you can do readily with analytic means.
Okay.
So, definitely can be improved upon. Okay. Another modification is, this is related to the event style signals. Is that it's possible for the inflow time in the mini disks to become comparable to or shorter than the binary period. And when that's the case, this whole picture of the mini discs needs to be strongly modified. Lastly, if this is a factor of 10 across the quote notch, in any actual practical single spectrum, you're never going to see the whole thing. You know, the optical spectra span may be a factor of 2 most. So what's more likely is that you would see, let's say, that part, or maybe this part. And searching for these involves finding one or the other of those edges. And then if you thought it was a really good case, maybe you'd go out and get spectrum in the corresponding band for the other one to check it out.
So then if you had days later, are you talking about the shocks onto the mini disks? Or
For which?
The streaming shocking on the mini disks and the reconnection and then when they join it.
Yeah.
Are you going to talk about this?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's the next slide.
Okay. So, because it ties back to the more to the
right.
To LMS.
Oh, yes.
No, this is
yes.
I mean, from an observational perspective, I'm very skeptical about this in the sense that, I mean, sadly, these things living in galaxies then end up having tons of other emission signatures on top of the thermal spectrum emission line.
Oh.
And not even before that, all of the SDSS quasars have shown that they, most of them don't even behave like an actual nautical tone disk, right? So
I think
when you look in detail, there are deviations. So you don't to find a modification, a decrement with respect to something that doesn't even behave like a template.
Well, I think you need to talk a little more quantitatively. And the first is that if these are 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 solar mass systems, and if they're accreting at some fraction of Eddington, which is not tiny, then their luminosity will be easily comparable to a galaxy. And so you don't have to worry so much about the other parts. The second is that there are two generic ways in which observed AGN spectra differ from Novikov-Thorne. One of them is that the characteristic power law across the optical and near ultraviolet is not as hard as the classic nu to the one-third. The second is that there's evidence that almost independent of luminosity, the spectrum rolls over somewhere between Lyman alpha and the Lyman cutoff, somewhere in the 1,000-ish angstrom range. Here, what we're really looking for is an interruption in whatever that smooth spectrum is in the optical and UV. So the detailed shape could be different due to whatever is really going on in AGN disks to make them non-classical, but an interruption which might still be there.
I don't argue against this, but I think observationally it's very challenging. You could take a single system to make a convincing case. Again, we're using multiple lines of evidence.
Okay, so another of the signals that's been proposed is the result of the energy dissipated when the accretion streams strike the outer edges of the mini disks. And again, if we're looking in this regime of hundreds, thousands of RG, so there is some energy to work with to produce a signal, the post-shock temperature is pretty high. Say that this notation is this, the first number in the parentheses refers to the primary, the second to the secondary. So generically, 10 to the 9 Kelvin, that's very high temperature. It's difficult to make a thermal spectrum unless you have very high densities and optical depths. In this particular case, if you estimate the optical depth, because you have some estimate of the accretion rate in the stream and of its size, you get a Comptonization factor of order several. Compton Y. Okay. Now, that, of course, is basically the product of the optical depth to Compton scattering and KT over MC square. This tells you KT over MC square is going to be order unity, or a little less. And the implicit statement here is the Compton optical depth is 5 to 10. So this, I think, is an unlikely place to thermalize. And what's more likely to happen is that most of the energy, in fact, will come out in hard X-rays, and in a fairly strongly Comptonized form. If you estimate the cooling time for Compton, inverse Compton scattering, and compare it to the binary orbital frequency, it's short. So it goes splat and whoosh, and then cools. But so it will cool down to more normal disky temperatures, but the energy all comes out when it's hot.
Some energy presumably may be lost to pair production in this very high temperature.
Sure.
It may not all come.
But the pairs will then annihilate eventually. So it's still hard X-rays. It may. What I think generically happens there is that the temperature is a little lower if you're putting energy into pairs. The Compton depth, of course, is greater, so there's more Comptonization at a somewhat lower temperature. But what that means is you go from, say, 6/10 to the 9 to 2/10 to the 9, something of that variety. Now, another interesting thing about this is, maybe before I say that, because of the strong Comptonization, the spectrum of these X-rays is likely to be, if anything, harder than the spectrum of the, quote, ordinary coronal X-rays made by the inner regions of the accretion disk. This is a supplement to the ordinary AGN X-rays, and may emerge at somewhat higher energies. It's also potentially observable in a different way, because its luminosity will follow the accretion rate. Here's this cooling time, which is very short. So it'll track the accretion rate very well. If the accretion rate is modulated at the lump orbital frequency, so should the output of X-rays. But we've spoken about all the time series problems. You'll see this phrase repeated in several of the slides. In addition, just working at tens of kilovolts is tough. There's high particle background for spacecraft in orbit. So to get around that, you need focusing optics. You're only looking at a very small photons from a very small direction in the sky. And you can achieve that with multifoil mirrors, as in NuSTAR. The problem is, when you have focusing optics, they generally force you to a small field of view, which makes it hard to do an all-sky survey.
This difficulty may be alleviated if you measure a gravitational wave exactly the same frequency.
Yeah, or let's say if you're checking out one of these notch signals. Suppose you have a maybe notch. Then maybe you go look at it in X-rays and see if there's anything going on.
But again, it has to be something
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
Some other independent
one-layer. Yes. You add three straws together. Okay. Now, as an exercise to see whether this is at all feasible, Marta and I recently took the output of a galaxy evolution simulation, folded it through an emission model for the notch and the hard X-ray signals, because the simulation gave data on the accretion rates to be expected on the supermassive binary to be formed. And the total number of sources in the sky as a function of flux, brighter than a certain flux, shown by these two curves. This is the X-ray signal, the notch signal. And maybe at sort of moderately searchable fluxes, 10 to minus 13-ish and above, there could be of order 100. Interestingly, Alberto's earlier estimate gave a number just a few times bigger, a totally different set of simulations and different assumptions about the accretion rate, and still kind of mysterious to us how we landed close to the same spot. And coincidentally, by the way, the flux limit for E rho zeta in their all-sky survey is a little bit more than 10 to minus 13, 1.6 10 to minus 13. And the contrast of really good focusing, boom, versus large field of view.
So what's the product there? So we have the Chatter deep field and the E rho zeta, different flux limits, different field of view. Mm-hmm. If you take the product, which of them is likely to give you the larger number of counts?
Oh. Well, of course, we didn't even calculate past several 10 to minus 16. I suppose, and they have somewhat different slopes here. In fact, the X-ray is a relevant one to Chandra. So if you take that out here, so that would be 10 to the 5 or 6 in the sky. So let's see, if it's a 10 to the 5, that means there'd be a few per square degree. And what's the Chandra field of view?
Chandra field is a few minutes.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Okay. So you need a bunch of fields, but Chandra's observed a bunch of fields, but this is the deep field limit. So the question is, how many Chandra fields of view have been done with 7 megaseconds of integration?
Yeah, not a lot.
There are not many 7 megaseconds.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So E-Rosita still wins.
Right. And the difficulty there is it's a 2 to 10 kilovolt instrument. So you might look for those that have harder spectra than average and double check that the hardness is not due to absorption at the low end. Mm-hmm. And that might be at least a candidate list, but that would, as Tamara said, that this is probably going to be a multi-step process.
I mean, on the other hand, Eurozeta is mostly sensitive in the soft X, right?
Yeah.
Which is not optimal for this hard X.
Yeah. Okay. So, yet another mechanism that's been proposed is that you might search for a period in the thermal continuum, the optical UV. And potentially two mechanisms that might create this. They're sort of schematically sketched in this figure from a paper by Alberto and Luke Kelly and Sol Timon. Namely, there's the accretion stream modulation, and there's Doppler boosting because they're in an orbit. Okay. The problem with the accretion stream modulation comes back to, I think, the question Eleanor raised, which is that at wide separation, and these are basically normal accretion disks inside the Roche lobes, with a large contrast between the tidal truncation radius and the ISCO, the inflow time that you might expect is likely to be quite a lot longer than the orbital period, which is more or less the time scale of the modulation. So that would wash out the effect of the accretion rate modulation. And the only way to get around that is to go to small separation. There's a push to a somewhat similar place by the Doppler modulation, because of course that's a RG over A to the 1/2 number. And for it to be noticeable, you probably want a separation less than or order 100 RG. You get a 10% effect. Okay. There have also been attempts to work on emission line profiles, and I think Tamara is the local expert on these. the basic picture is to imagine that each black hole carries its own broad emission line region around with it, the orbit, and that these broad line regions would be more or less like the ones we're accustomed to seeing around solitary black. And what you might expect to see is perhaps a double peak profile, because they're, you know, each one's being carried by a different black hole, or that there's something about the profile that's periodically varying. And it's a little unclear what, you know, there are various kinds of somethings you might imagine. Here are the difficulties. Are first, that if the dynamics in the broad line region are at least tied to the gravitational orbit scale, and I say that carefully, because what we know about the dynamics of the broad line region is extremely limited. Okay. But if somehow the motions are at least correlated with the gravitational scale, then when the two regions are cleanly separated in space, is exactly the time when the velocity difference between the two black holes is small, which means that the profiles are superimposed in wavelength space. So that doesn't help.
So let's say that no one is actually looking for double peak profiles in observations.
Yeah, that was a program of several years ago when people tried that.
Yeah, I don't think that that's been ruled out. Double peak mirrors have been ruled out.
Right, and in part for this reason.
Or by reason. No, not for that reason, just because the time for those candidates that can be looked at, double peak mirrors, the time scale doesn't work out, and there are other reasons why they are not expected to be double peak mirrors.
Yeah. So now, so the other side of it, so suppose you bring the broad line regions close enough so that the velocity separation is more interesting, and you can actually separate them somehow. Now you have interacting systems. The gas in all the broad emission line gas sees the ionizing light from two different sources. It also feels the gravitational potential due to two different black hole masses. And depending on what you imagine for the dynamics of the system, there might be gas flows within each one that interact in between. So it's very hard to predict what specific kind of alteration there might be due to this binary configuration. And this is an illustration of just basically we understand a lot about sort of binary dynamics and thinking about accretion. We know a lot less about more complicated gas arrangements as must characterize the broad emission line region, which there are also see kinematic reasons why it's probably not a simple disk. So it's a little hard to know in advance what exactly to look for. If you did see something, some feature in the profile that indubitably was periodically varying, that would be very interesting. So that'd be exciting if seen. It'd be much harder to interpret than the other kinds of things, because basically there's so little we know about how the broad line region works.
So can I make a statement here, since I'm a local expert in detail? Very local. So I agree that the picture is very messy, but some of the ideas are clearly emerging from simulations. There are going to be three disks, two mini disks, the third circumlocutor disk around it. So that's very important if you're going to think about broad line regions. Mm-hmm. There are going to be two accreting black holes, and that is telling you that you are going to have two sources of continuum radiation, and that you are going to have a non-axis symmetric illumination pattern, very important ingredient for broad line regions and their illumination. So with those simplest of assumptions, ignoring all the complexities, you can ask yourself, why do you expect those lines, produced by such simple systems, two images illuminated by two different sources, do you expect them to have some feature that is statistically different from all other NGMs? So the question is not just looking for at a single object looking for periodicity, but looking statistically for anything that distinguishes a set of objects from all other AGM.
But what do you put in about the where the gas is in order to suggest what kind of feature might result?
So basically, you make your assumptions as simple as possible. That's what I said. Two mini disks with some emissivity pattern, and...
The lines are coming off the disk surfaces?
The lines are coming off the broadline region surfaces that are associated with those.
Well, that's a... I would emphasize the question mark in that phrase.
Okay, we can argue about the details. But my point is that you can think about this in many different ways. If binary is truncating broadline regions with the gravitational force, would you expect lines to be broader? Would you expect them to look different because we have two sources of illumination as opposed to a single AGM and in one axis symmetric broadline region and so on? And I think that those questions are worth asking statistically.
Yeah, the difficulty, I agree that they should certainly be unusual. And the question is, what kind of unusual?
I mean, I considering what you have said until now, I think that in all cases, whatever your choice of diagnostic is, you will have candidates. And as Tamara said from the very beginning, you need different probes at the same time to trust something to actually do that.
But yeah, it's hard. Certainly it's hard, and this is not going to be a single one that it's
Can you flip it and think of the opposite? Just look at the AGM, assume it's a single one. Think of the simplest possible model, and then do a null test to try to find out what is not behaving like a single AGM.
No. Because A, we don't have a good model. The broadline region single AGNs.
But if we don't have a single one, we're not going to have
a single one. That's exactly my point. And what we do see is a good deal of variation of profiles from one object to the next.
Yeah.
Can I add in a complication? All of these simulations are done where the angular momentum vector of the disk and the binary are aligned. And what if there are misaligned, you'll create warps, you'll create precessions, and you'll not see it in the jet. And that will be on a much larger scale in sort of a helical type of structure.
Yeah, and it's true that I believe almost all of these simulations have assumed aligned. A small fraction of them have assumed aligned but retrograde. The misaligned case is interesting, and what I'd say is that the preference for aligned is partly fewer parameters you have to specify for the simulation and simpler physics, but also partly because there are tendencies that push these systems toward alignment. Again, tendencies, but not watertight, and
because you're feeding the external fields from the interest that are medium,
but that's how you draw that's if that if the source of angular momentum is consistent in direction over a substantial period in time, that's actually what drives the aligning tendencies. It's that direction. And in a different paper with Cole, we estimated a number of the timescales for alignment of variously the circumbinary disk with the binary orbit and the mini disks with the binary orbit and the black hole spins as well. And we came up with moderately short times for these alignments, but it certainly depends on having a steady direction of angular momentum in the supply over the timescale.
So if the black hole spins are misaligned, then assume.
Well, there's yet another one. That's a, there's a, there are many, many things here. There are the binary orbit, right?
Yeah.
Is external disk, mm-hmm. the internal small disk, and yeah. then the spin.
That's right. There are five different angular momenta.
Yeah. I mean, one thing we actually found is that in this configuration, the alignment of the black hole spins with the angular momentum coming in through the circumbinary disk is more rapid than it would be for single black holes because of the way the torques work. So as Julian is saying, it's not a guarantee, but the time scale is shorter than you might have feared. So this is a special and easy configuration, but also quite likely a plausible one in many circumstances. Won't be exact, but fairly close, may seem reasonable.
Can I also insert a comment, but did anyone hear? No. My comment is that, I think you made a good case for alignment, but if there was any misalignment, that would be really very interesting. So I think that in terms of what we expect to see observationally, it's really important to keep our minds open again, because this misalignment would allow for cross illumination of one disk by another, and by AGN illumination of this for the other black hole. And that is going to be really interesting in terms of any electromagnetic signatures, warping,
binary stars, there are binary stars, we see one component edge up, the other component is a face up.
Which kind of observable do you expect to be influenced by any of these assuming that it takes place?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No,
I mean,
are we talking about jets?
That'd be one example.
We're not touching jets yet, even just the spectrum of the disk. If you have a black hole that is misaligned with the disk and you have this source of radiation which is in the middle.
I can see that from a modern perspective, but if you want to reverse engineer,
I'm going to
trace it back to probably like a little bit in a binary.
Well, I think the source of contamination at the moment, because it's not something we have modeled, but whatever you have will be something weird. And we have been talking all the time, although we don't know what binarity actually does in all these cases because there are caveats, it will always be something weird.
I think even the single case is weird.
Oh, yes.
So discriminating levels of weirdness is going to be a very challenge.
Okay, so it's almost 11 o'clock, but I think this last bit is quick. I said earlier, everything so far has been long-lived signals where the issue is how many are there in the sky to look for. But you could also ask, what about events? There are more and more transient observatories, first PTF and then CTF, and now LSST a couple of years from now. And maybe there would be short-lived signals sufficiently bright that they could be picked up by these transient observatories. And there, presumably, would be in systems actually approaching merger. So with separations small enough, tens of RG, that relativistic corrections to the dynamics are, in fact, important. Now, there's a characteristic time scale. So we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of years. We're talking about weeks or months. Here, an interesting thing. Change happens. Roughly speaking, the tidal truncation radius of these mini disks is about a third of the binary separation with a correction for mass ratio. So that means that if you're talking about a separation of, say, 20 RG, where that's the total mass RG, then each disk might have a size of 6 or 7 in those units. Depending on the mass ratio, well, if it's even mass ratio, then that translates to 12 in its own mass, depending for non-equal mass ratios, and of course it's going to be different. But that's not a huge factor larger than the position of the ISCA. As this Schwarzschild, it's only a factor of 2. So that means that these disks are different. The contrast in specific angular momentum of a circular orbit at twice the ISCO to at the ISCO is not that big, which means that those internal stresses don't have a big job to accomplish in order to permit matter to move inward. In addition, when that ratio is only a factor of 2, radial pressure gradients can be significant. After all, whatever happens inside the ISCO, the gas pressure drops sharply. It's accelerating inward. So the mechanisms of accretion are different and faster. And that means that the inflow time can, in fact, actually now be short enough that whatever is happening in the mini disk is actually tracking the rate at which matter is being fed to it. And these curves are from a recent paper of a simulation treating a case like this. This was one with initial separation of 20 RG, circular orbit. And these are the power spectra of a variety of quantities. The masses in the individual disks, blue and orange. The total mass combining the two disks, in green. And, you know, there's still a lump, the ratio of it to the binary frequency. Okay, so this is in here, and it has a width for a couple of reasons. One is that if you track the sort of point of highest density contrast in the lump, it often follows an eccentric orbit, so phi dot changes. In addition, the simulation went long enough and the orbital evolution is quick enough that the orbit actually shrank a bit during the period. Okay. That's the swing. And then you have a peak here at 0.7. That's the beat frequency between the binary orbital frequency and the lump frequency. And you see a strong modulation for, let's see, blue and orange, the two individual masses, but not for the total. The total has a quasi-period of about 0.3 or 0.4, and a somewhat weaker one here at twice the beat frequency. So in this regime, the interaction of the orbital frequency of the asymmetry and the binary orbital frequency, given the short inflow time in the disks, gives you this sort of resonant chamber in which quite a number of periodic variations appear. And this will be a case where, as you can see, the accretion rate modulation should be imprinted. And it's close enough, the Doppler boosting and beaming really are strong. Okay. It's interesting for a further reason, in that the end of this period is the immediate prelude to the merger itself. So if you'd like to know what happens to nearby gas when the binary actually goes through the merger, this gives the initial conditions. It tells you how much gas, where, doing what. And let's close with another simulation. This is data from a simulation that completed about 3 weeks ago. So you'll probably have many questions to which my answer is, we intend to look at that. The frame rate changes here, so you can see things kind of slow motion. So you can see that there's strong asymmetry in the masses of the disks. But if you follow any one black hole, you'll see that the mass of its disk oscillates in time. That's the modulation you saw in the previous slide. You can also see that there are streams going back and forth between the two. And these are also seen in Newtonian simulations like Andrew's, but at lower amplitude. Turns out that the potential through the L1 point actually gets a little shallower in the post-Newtonian regime than in pure Newtonian. what you can also see is that As the simulation proceeds, in this case, the orbit is evolving under gravitational wave losses. It goes from a separation of about 20 to, I think, about 11 or 12 at the end. And the mass in the disks diminishes. One of the few bits of fluid analysis that we've done so far is a rough estimate of the accretion rate, and it doesn't change a whole lot. But the inflow time gets shorter and shorter because the tidal truncation radii of these disks gets closer and closer to the ISCO, these most Schwarzschild black holes. So just the mass in the disk is T inflow times M dot, and that gets smaller. And as they get closer to one another, see them, this is where they really start to, the separation really starts to shrink. You'll see that the disks get kind of wispy.
See, it's like a Schwarzschild perturbed Schwarzschild matrix, where you cut off the gas flow around each black hole.
It actually goes to the horizon. There's a masking on the horizon of each black hole, but the flow continues. It really does go into the black hole. And the way it's constructed is that there, there's different patches being computed separately, exchanging boundary conditions. The outer region has a high order PN spacetime, which is asymptotically matched to perturbed Schwarzschild in the inner mini disk regions, where the perturbation, of course, is the tidal stuff from the partner. The orbital evolution is done at higher order PN. And spherical grid outside, Cartesian grid inside, so that we have no coordinate singularity at the origin. And usually in disks, you want polar coordinates so that the flow travels around in, it changes only in one coordinate. It's not really a big Cartesian does as well as polar in this case.
So in terms of observability, isn't it concerned the fact that it's essentially the inflow time becomes much a lot shorter because of the tidal compression of the disk, because of the tidal pool. So essentially the gas is going in mostly because of energy, angular momentum loss through tidal interaction rather than dissipation. So that gives you less, room for emission, really.
Yeah, I think.
Couldn't that be a problem for?
I think the way I look at it, it can. Amongst the things we're definitely intending to look at is actually the dissipation rate. And yes, just because there's the quantity of gas is smaller, there may be less coming out. The whole picture of accretion is different. I doubt that the usual story of dissipation mostly by short length scale dissipation of MHD turbulence is relevant. I think it's much more likely to be dominated by shocks.
And Jeff Bryan has a really nice paper on the mini disks in GR, and he finds very strong spiral shock waves, which you probably are seeing there as well. And they dissipate most of the energy, it's like an effective alpha of 20.5 or something.
And in fact, we probably need even larger. And like the whole alpha picture, the whole Thorne picture goes away. These are not axisymmetric, these are not time steady. These nowhere is far from either the outer edge or the inner edge.
And the spectrum is different from that one as well.
It has to be. All these, every one of the assumptions is broken. Things have got to change.
So I have a question, which may be a good closing argument. So these are very nice, and I'm looking forward to reading the paper. But can you tell us, as a conclusion, what things are not accounted for by modern-day simulations? For example, interaction of radiation and matter, the way how cooling is calculated in these simulations, and how do you expect these to affect, if at all, the results?
Okay.
What is the issue?
The principle lacking in these simulations is the equation of state. In all of, basically, in the overwhelming majority of global disk simulations to date, the equation of state is either wholly ignored because the algorithm itself is lossy, or if you're using an intrinsically conservative fluid algorithm, which recent simulations have all done, then there's an artificial ad hoc cooling term so that you can get rid of the heat released in dissipation. And this is just put in by hand in a way that you either keeps the gas at its initial specific entropy or keeps the gas close to a desired ratio of scale height to radius. Often it's, and these are done partly because you need something to get rid of the heat, and it's simple. Also, the values that are chosen are so that the geometric thickness is one you can resolve. Typically, H over R somewhere in the 10th range is what's chosen. So that is the key element of unreality. And the next question is, which properties do you think will be affected the most? And here, what I would expect is that the 3D structure here could be affected because when there's strong shocks or strong heating, and it can matter, especially for the 3D structure, how fast that's radiated. And, you know, our rate for that is wholly arbitrary. The existence of the shocks and the 2D dynamics, I would think, would be less seriously affected because mostly they're the result of orbital trajectories and gravity, and we know how to do those pretty well, and we're doing those pretty well, and the fact that there is a shock. In other disk simulations, if you have more conventional, you plunk down out here somewhere, so now you're out at, say, 50 or 60 m, the equation of state comes in two different ways. One, of course, there's still the question of, is it the right cooling rate and what should be the thickness of the disk? The second is that if the accretion rate is more than a small fraction of Eddington, and if the mass is large, it's the 7/10 to the 8 solar masses, then you expect the pressure to be dominated by radiation. And that has interesting consequences. It can contribute to vertical support against gravity. It can also, as indicated by some very new simulations by Yanfei Jiang, I don't know where he is this morning, he's a local postdoc, and Jim Stone, Omer Blaze, Shane Davis, is that even though the radiation pressure is large compared to the gas pressure, the vertical support is actually magnetic, mostly magnetic. But these are brand new, single examples.
Those are very stable disks.
Yes.
So they have to find those from magnetic support.
Well, they have two simulations. Yeah. They differ by about a factor of 3 in accretion rate. And they're similar in that both have very large ratios of radiation to gas pressure. And both are mostly magnetically supported, but the degree of that mostly is different. And some of the other detailed properties are also different. And I'll just say that when they sent me a draft a couple weeks before submission for comments, I sent a list of about 20 questions, of which they could answer maybe 2. You know, this is brand new stuff.
If say that is the structure of the disks, would you expect that to change this picture in any way?
Okay. I think their results are probably most relevant here and not particularly relevant here. Because they're looking, these are simulations around solitary black holes, where the structure is smoother and basically less irregular all the way down towards the approach to the ISCO. So that's why I think it's more relevant to the sort of calmer circumbinary disk than to these dramatically fluctuating mini disks. I guess another indication is that their disks statistically do follow the Novikov-Thorne assumption. Statistically, they're axisymmetric. Statistically, they're in inflow equilibrium out to several times the ISCO. They do have local radiation of the dissipation. And that's probably good out here and not at all in here. These are clearly drastically out of inflow equilibrium.
No. Also because we have to, there's another reading, so we have to do it at some point. So did you have any final
remarks? That's the end.
Okay. So if there's no final remarks, let's thank you for. So thank you.